What is Zionism? What is its history? And what is its opposition, anti-Zionism? And what constitutes this history? The conversation has gotten so loud, yet it seems people don't really know the definitions of the terms themselves. It's time to cut through the rhetoric, noise, slogans, and soundbites and offer the debate an intelligible context. Join us to journey through the historical roots of this debate.
The State of Israel was born not after the Holocaust so that never again. The State of Israel was intended to be born by the Zionist leaders before so that never at all.
In each episode, we will explore how every type of Zionist thought was opposed by a certain brand of anti-Zionism. And we reflect on how these various debates persist to this day. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of Zionism and Anti-Zionism, the history of two opposing ideas. Let's take stock of where we're at. The Jewish people are facing a peculiar moment in history, having been promised emancipation and equal rights in Western Europe after 2,000 years of exile from Israel. Do they assimilate and completely reconfigure Judaism to fit Europe? Do they fight for global socialist utopia and against all nations and particular identities? Do they join the Bund to fight for socialist utopia, taking into account Jewish particularism? Or do they begin to believe in Zionism, the liberation movement aimed to free the Jewish people and somehow return them back to their homeland? But the debate does not stop here. Zionism emerged as a secular movement, but in time, religious Jews too had to contend with these revolutionary ideas. In this episode, we ask, how does Zionism fit with Jewish theology? We have focused exclusively on the debate within the Jewish community. But now, we will also look at the debate outside of it, as we consider Christian Zionism and anti-Zionism too. Here is the historical breakdown.
Zionism at the beginning was a secular movement. In many ways, it had to be a secular movement, because Zionism was a rebellion against what became at that point a Jewish passive religious attitude of waiting for the Messiah. So Zionism essentially rebelled against this passive religious attitude and calling on the Jews not to passively pray for the Messiah, but rather be their own messiahs, be the vehicles of their self-redemption. But from the beginning, Zionism had religious people who were Zionists, who basically, even though they saw the rebellion that Zionism was, they appreciated what Zionism was doing and viewed it as part of their Jewish ritual. But that was marginal. What you had in the beginning was Jewish religious opposition to Zionism, because it was a secular movement, a rebellion against God. And for those religious Jews who opposed Zionism, the growing success of Zionism presented a challenge.
Emancipation meant that Jews were increasingly being let out of the ghettos. This meant that Jews were encountering non-Jewish cultures and ideas. The dilemma then, facing the traditional religious authorities, was how do we respond? The modern Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox of today represent a different cumulative response to the challenge of modernity, a way to preserve what they viewed as the traditional Jewish way of life. One of the other central questions that religious Jews faced in the late 19th and early 20th centuries was, how do we relate to Zionism? Initially, most religious Jews were harshly opposed to Zionism, including many Orthodox Jews already living in Ottoman Palestine. For one, religious Jews rejected the secular character of early Zionists. In addition, the traditional position of religious Jews to the prospect of returning to the land of Israel was that the Jewish people must wait for the coming of the Messiah. Over the years, interpretations of passages from the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, one of the final books of the Hebrew Bible, clarified three oaths that the Jewish people and God swore. One, the Jews would not collectively return to the land of Israel. Two, the Jews would respect the law of the lands that they inhabited. Three, in exchange, non-Jewish rulers would not treat the Jews too poorly. However, as the Zionist movement grew, religious Jews became increasingly willing to support the settling of the Jews in the land of Israel. Harav Abraham Isaac Hook played a central role in offering theological justification for supporting Zionism. Harav was, from a very young age, special. He was a top student and quickly became an internationally respected Jewish scholar. In 1905, Harav immigrated to the land of Israel. Most famously, Harav Cook became the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the Jewish community in Palestine, the institution which later became the Israeli chief rabbinate. What then of the secular nature of Zionism and Zionists? Here is where Harav Cook is unique. Unlike most Orthodox rabbis of his time, Harav Cook declared that the secular Zionists were actually part of the Messianic plan. They were not inhibitors of the bringing of the Messiah, but rather vehicles for the bringing of the Messiah. Yet in the decades preceding Israeli independence in 1948, most religious Jews remained anti-Zionist. However, the prosperity of the State of Israel began to convince many religious Jews that Zionism was a divinely ordained cause. Harav's son, Tzvi Yehuda, took over the mantle of spiritual leader of religious Zionism after his father's passing. Unlike his dad, Tzvi Yehuda had to adapt his theology to a world where Israel existed as a state. To Tzvi Yehuda, Israeli independence in 1948 was both a blessing, as the Jews finally reclaimed sovereignty in the land of Israel, but also a letdown, because the entirety of the biblical land of Israel was not under Israeli control. Then, in 1967 and 1973, when Israel conquered and defended Judea and Samaria, also known as the West Bank, against much larger forces, Tzvi Yehuda's unfulfilled aspirations for Jewish settlement in these historically and spiritually significant areas were suddenly a possibility. In fact, according to Tzvi Yehuda, settling in Judea and Samaria was the religious duty of Jews. Herein lies the religious inspiration for the so-called settlement movement. Founded by students of Tzvi Yehuda in 1974, the Bloc of the Faithful sought to prevent Israel from returning any territories of biblical Israel. Maintaining Jewish presence and sovereignty over all the land of Israel was necessary for the coming of the Messiah. Subsequent generations of settlers relocated to the West Bank for other reasons as well, including an interest in Israeli security or because land and property is cheaper there. Still, though, the core of the settlement movement, which today is manifested by Israelis who choose to live deep in the West Bank as opposed to the large blocks very close to mainland Israel, is made up of religiously motivated Israelis. Since 1967, most religious Jews, Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, have become Zionists, or at the very least, not anti-Zionists. Of course, there are some outliers today who hold on to the traditional, theologically based anti-Zionism, including the ultra-Orthodox Satmar and Neturei Carter sects. However, these groups are marginal to both the larger Jewish world and the ultra-Orthodox landscape. In learning about the lives and ideology of Harav Cook, his son, and the Israeli settlement movement, we begin to understand how the relationship between Zionism and religious Jews has evolved and been revolutionized.
The Jewish God is not a God of nature, it's a God of history, and through the history of the Jewish people, God sends the message to the world as to what should and should not be done. This means that a lot of Jewish interpretation is how historical events, exile, the bringing down of the sovereignties and the temples, how to interpret historic events in light of what happened to the Jews, and thereby to look at those historic events to understand what God wants and what is the message of God to the world. Now, this kind of religious, theological, Jewish anti-Zionism is based on a notion that is called the three oaths. This comes from the book of the Song of Songs, which really is a book about love. And it talks about the fact that you can't quicken love. You can't force it. It has to be done in its own time, in its own terms, which is a great recommendation in general for love. But what Jewish sages over the years did while in exile is interpret this text as essentially meaning that there is a covenant, a kind of agreement, an oath between God and the Jewish people when he sent them into exile. Because remember, it's never the Babylonians who send the Jews into exile. It's never the Romans who send the Jews into exile. It's always God through the Babylonians, through the Romans, who is acting in history to send a message. So while the Jews were in exile, the idea was that there are three oaths. This is part of a so-called agreement between God and the Jewish people, that they will not force the going back into the land of Israel. So they will not do it by force. They will just passively pray for God to do it. So the Jews promise not to do it before the time. They promise not to do it en masse or by force. And God promises on his side that the nations will not treat the Jews badly. So this is the Jewish religious opposition to Zionism, and it's theological. And when you read, for example, the works of the Satmar Rabbi, when you look at the declarations of the Natura Carta, the more extreme sects of Jewish life that oppose Zionism on religious grounds, they basically look at Zionism as an aberration. It's something that was indeed a rebellion against Jewish life, a rebellion against God, and they expect it not to continue. They expect Zionism at one point to come to a cataclysmic end. Today in Israel, within the Satmar and the Natura Carta, you have even the more extreme elements that believe it is their role to help the world rid itself of this secular aberration in Jewish history. That's why you will see them supporting Israel's enemies, participating in anti-Israel demonstrations, meeting with Palestinian leaders who want to see Israel gone, work with Iranian leaders who want to see Israel gone, because they believe that for God to fulfill his promise to the people, the state of Israel has to be destroyed. Sometimes when people see these very religious-looking Jews appearing in demonstrations saying Zionism is not Judaism or Judaism is against Zionism, they think, oh no, what has happened today in Israel? What has Israel done today? Rather than understanding that this has nothing to do with Israel's actions, Israel could be just the most perfect country possible, and yet they would still oppose it on theological grounds, because Israel should not exist, because the people who created the state of Israel rebelled against God, broke the oaths, they did it on their own time rather than waiting for God, and therefore Israel should not exist. And whenever God decides to send the Jewish people back to the land of Israel, God will do it in his own good time, but it's not up to the Jewish people to decide it. So this is the religious basis for Jewish anti-Zionism. But we also know that Jewish religious Zionism is a very powerful force, certainly today in Israeli politics. If Zionism was a secular movement, where did Jewish religious Zionism come from? So again, there was always this religious Zionist sentiment. You also see it most powerfully among Jews who lived under the lands of the Arab world and Islam, known today as Mizrahi Jews. But Zionism generally, for much of the years of building, the pre-state years and the early years of the State of Israel, was a secular movement. Religious Jews who adopted Zionism, they had to give an explanation, a theological explanation, for why Zionism was spearheaded by people who were not believers, who essentially threw off the idea of belief, many of them threw off the idea of ritual. And why is it actually that those secular people were doing the thing that God promised the Jews, the restoration of the Jews in their homeland? So their theological explanation was that essentially, unbeknownst to those secular Jews, they were doing God's work. It's the general idea of all religions that God works in mysterious ways. So this is how religious Zionism created the theological justification. And what happened is that the more Zionism became successful, the more religious Zionism could claim that this was the work of God. So greater success became greater evidence that Zionism was indeed what God wanted for the Jewish people. Religious Zionism then began to look at early Zionism as the beginning of redemption. Yes, we are now living in the era of redemption. The beginning of redemption was carried out by secular Jews, but ultimately this is a religious undertaking. Unsurprisingly, the moment when religious Zionism really takes off is after the Six-Day War. Again, the idea of 6 days, God made the world in 6 days. And the Six-Day War is also the war that brings into the possession of Israel not just the Sinai and the Golan Heights and the Gaza Strip. It's the West Bank, which is where Judea is. This is the cradle of Jewish civilization. The Wailing Wall, the Temple Mount, they come under Israeli possession as a result of the 1967 Six-Day War. In 1973, only 6 years after that, the Yom Kippur War. So again, very symbolic. On Yom Kippur, the holiest day for the Jewish people, Israel is attacked. There's a sense of near demise. Ultimately able to eke victory from that sense of doom. So these two events, the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War, in very close proximity, ignite a revival of religious Zionism. For a lot of people, this is really proof that Zionism is God's work. And this is when you begin to see the settlement movement take off and religious Zionism becomes a powerful force. So again, we can see here how Jewish theology, Jewish interpretation can both be supportive of anti-Zionism and Zionism. Up until now, we've been essentially engaging in an internal Jewish discussion, motivated by the rise of modernity and the need of the Jews to answer the question of how to be a Jew in the modern era with all the new ideas of modernity. We've seen how Jews can be for emancipation and for Zionism, how Jews can support communism, socialism, Bundism, and labor Zionism, how Jewish religious interpretations can support Zionism and anti-Zionism. But all of these are essentially internal Jewish debates, and where Jews are all seeking the same thing. They are all ultimately seeking the good of the Jewish people. They might have very opposing ideas about how to achieve the good of the Jewish people, but even as they proclaim opposing ideas, they share the same end goal of how to secure the Jewish people in the modern era. But this is, up until this point, an internal Jewish debate. Now we enter the place where Zionism and anti-Zionism go to the broader world, where it becomes relevant to the present day, and where you have the big numbers. So first we'll start with Christianity. And not just Christianity as a religion, but also Christianity as the system, the culture, the civilization that underpins the West as a whole. Christianity developed a theology in the beginning. The Jews who rejected conversion, who rejected Christ, the role of those remaining Jews was to be a cautionary tale. The fact that the Jews were stateless and powerless was necessary for Christian theology for a very long time, because as long as Jews were stateless and powerless, this validated Christianity. This really meant that Jews were a cautionary tale. They were suffering precisely because they were no longer God's chosen, because God no longer loved them, and therefore they suffered. The early Christian churches are actually built to look upon the ruins of the Temple Mount, to really kind of look at what has remained of the Jewish people, nothing but ruins. So it's important in the beginning of Christianity to understand that Jewish powerlessness and statelessness are essential for Christian theology. We know today that certainly in the United States and in Britain, there are very strong elements of Christianity that support Israel, that support Zionism. Where did those come from if Jewish powerlessness and Jewish statelessness were necessary for Christian theology? Well, they emerge after the Reformation. During the Reformation, with the invention of print, people begin to read the Bible directly. They read both the Old and the New Testament. If you've ever read the Old Testament, if you read the Tanakh, the Jews are pretty impressive there. They're kings, they're warriors, they're prophets, they're a fighting nation. And this is a very impressive story. It's an inspiring story. And you could imagine that as people had these Bible groups and Bible studies and they began to read it directly, their notion of who the Jews are begins to change. And the rise of what became known as Christian Zionism, but initially was known as Restorationism, from the idea of restoring the Jews to their land, comes from the reimagining of these poor, miserable, ghettoized Jews as the ancient Israelites. And once Christians can look upon the Jews not as a cautionary tale of misery, but rather as the heirs, the descendants of the ancient Israelites, they can imagine the restoration of those Jews in their ancient land. They can begin to imagine it also as a prophecy fulfilled. Restorationism rested on the idea that the restoration of the Jews in their homeland would be the fulfillment of a Christian prophecy, essentially looking at the Bible as one book, and that would validate Christianity rather than invalidate it the way that initial Christian theology worked. So that is the rise of Christian Restorationism, later known as Christian Zionism. It takes hold in England mostly, and then in the United States. From the early beginnings of the U.S., we see a very warm relationship towards the idea of Jews in their homeland. This idea in Europe has a moment with Napoleon, but it really comes together at the moment when the British Empire comes to control the land of Israel after World War I and after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Then you have the bringing together of British imperial interests with the theology, the Christian theology of the restoration of the Jews, and you begin to see people who are actively writing, people like George Eliot and Daniel Deronda, and many others, for whom the very idea of what it means to be British is to support Jewish restoration. We can see it also in the context of British support for Greek self-determination against the Ottoman Empire. Jewish self-determination is also a way against or post the Ottoman Empire. The idea also that the Greeks and the Jews underpin Western civilization. Britain is now the main carrier of Western civilization. So all these things come together to create British Christian support for Zionism, really manifested in the Balfour Declaration, in this British viewing with favor of the reestablishment of a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel. And today we see it especially in the United States with evangelical support for Zionism and the State of Israel. It's important to mention that most of this evangelical support is not Armageddon millenarian. I mean, it's basically the idea that God will bless those who bless the Jews. So very simple support. There are the minority who believe that this is the prequel to Armageddon and to the necessary conversion of everyone, but that is generally the minority. To the present, Christian Zionism remains a very powerful force, certainly in the United States. We cannot understand American support for Israel without understanding the sources of Christian Zionism. Now, America and the West also have a very strong element of anti-Zionism, which is not religious, supposedly. It's mostly in left-wing secular circles. But we need to understand that even that Western anti-Zionism remains deeply Christian theological. What we need to understand is that even when people in the West are nominally secular, there is still an underpinning of Christian history and ideas and civilization. So what we see in a lot of Western anti-Zionism today is the nominally secular but still deeply religious and theological idea that Jewish power, Jewish statehood, is an affront to Christianity, an affront to Western civilization.
Anti-Semitism began by creating a new collective designation for the same people which rendered them different. In secular 19th century Europe, it was no longer Jews, but Semites. And it never was intended to mean anything but Jews. In the Soviet Union, who claimed to not notice different religions and peoples, Jews were designated as Zionists. And today, in the West, in the UK, Zionists, Zios. The designation is then described as having essential, immutable, loathsome qualities. In Christian Europe, we were Christ killers. To the Nazis, we were an impure race. To the Soviets, we were capitalists and imperialists. And today, the State of Israel is the ultimate violator of human rights. It is described as born in sin. It is guilty by its very nature of the crimes of racism, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, Nazism, genocide.
So we see how both the support for Zionism can be viewed as necessary for Western civilization, necessary for Christianity, but also how anti-Zionism, how the desire to see Jews remain powerless, be stateless, also reflects a secularized but still deeply religious, theological, Christian early idea that only Jewish statelessness and powerlessness validates Christianity and validates the West.
It seems everybody, no matter how much or little they know about the conflict, is familiar with the picture of the religious Jews splashed in the front of a newspaper whenever Israel makes the news. But essentially what we've learned is that not only is this a tokenization of Jews from the anti-Israel movement, but these Jews themselves aren't fighting for Palestinian rights or against certain policies of the Israeli government.
What percentage of Jews ascribe to this theological ideology today?
So the number of Jews who are theologically anti-Zionist, the Natura Carta, the Satmar, is several thousands, maybe several tens of thousands, but that's about it. It's very small. That's why in most circles, they're almost described as Jewish sects. But they are also very useful because they dress the way that ultra-Orthodox Jews dress. This is what most people associate with the idea of being devoutly Jewish, of being very religiously Jewish. So first of all, they convey what most people have as the image of the Jew. And then, because they are theologically opposed to Zionism, they are very useful at deflecting the charge that anti-Zionism is against Jews, because you can have no better way to protect yourself than to have a very Jewish-looking Jew stand and say, Judaism is against Zionism, or Zionism is not the same as Judaism. People associate with the idea that they represent the solidarity of Jews with the Palestinian cause, but these Jews are motivated not by a concern specifically for Palestinians, but by a deep-seated theological opposition to Zionism in general as a secular movement, but not to the Zionist ideal of restoration. They don't want Zionism now, but they want Zionism later. This is the fundamental idea of Jews, that at one point they will be restored to their homeland. But they just believed that it was not secular Zionist job to do that. And that even if the Jews prayed for 2,000 years and it didn't happen, then they should pray for another 2,000. It's basically not for them to decide. So they're very useful, but they definitely do not represent the vast majority of Jews.
So many of the myths and narratives that ancient Christian hatred of Jews carried are now still found in secularized versions in the Western world. So what are some of the most powerful manifestations of that today?
So one of the major themes of the course was one of secularized religion, which might seem like a contradiction, but it is actually a very powerful idea that even when countries and societies become secular, the ideas that were implanted in those societies by religion don't just disappear. They often just reappear in a secularized form. So we saw a bit with labor Zionism, how in the poems they spoke about the land and working the land in almost religious terms, but it was a very secular movement that kind of secularized a certain religious impulse. In the same way, we see that the West, that has the underpinning of Christianity and Christian theology, many of these ideas reappear in their secularized form. So for example, we've studied about the blood libels, the idea that Jews engage in ritual murder of non-Jewish children, of Christian children, for the purpose of their rituals, Passover or something of the sort. And these blood libels were very powerful in Christianity, especially in medieval Christianity, and often happened before massacres of Jews. So you have these blood libels. But the blood libels went through a secularization process where you still see at the headlines of newspapers today the idea that Israel or Israeli soldiers kill non-Jewish, typically Palestinian children in a kind of ritual bloodlust. It's never reported as just a conflict and the idea that civilians get killed in conflict. What you always have a sense is this kind of ritual bloodlust. So that is the way that kind of an old Christian idea of the blood libels gets secularized. And for those who don't see the old religious underpinnings of their secular society, might just think that there's nothing odd about it. But in many ways, once you study the history, the theology, you can't unsee it.
In terms of Christian Zionism that led to increased support of the Balfour Declaration in Britain, how did the relationship of the British to Zionism develop from that point?
Once the Ottoman Empire collapsed, the British and the French wanted to divide the spoils of the empire and continue their imperial rule. But the United States wanted none of that. They wanted the end of the European colonial era, and they wanted the principle of self-determination. So the compromise that was found was based on the mandate system. The idea was that the peoples of the empires, and the Jews were a people of the Ottoman Empire, and there were Kurds, and there were Christian people, and there were, of course, Arabs. The idea was that the peoples of the Ottoman Empire would ultimately achieve self-determination, but because they were not as advanced as Europeans, they need tutors. And the tutors would be the French and the British through the mandate system. But ultimately, it was about self-determination. So the Arabs were going to achieve self-determination, and the Jews were going to achieve self-determination, and the British and the French were just going to tutor them in the process. So the Balfour Declaration, and what's more important, it became codified in the League of Nations, which really gave the full international legitimacy to Zionism and to Arab self-determination. But the Balfour Declaration becomes codified in the League of Nations mandate. So the British get a trust, a mandate from the world, recognizing the ancient connection between the people of Israel and the land of Israel to achieve self-determination. And British Zionism, of course, was critical in the notion that Britain, in order to be Britain, will help the Jews achieve self-determination, restoration. But of course, the Jews were a small people, had been, remain a small people. The Arabs were far more numerous, certainly the Muslims. And counteracting British Zionism was British anti-Zionism, was the idea that ultimately it made no sense for the British to support these small people. And as Arab opposition to Zionism became more fierce, more violent, Britain ultimately departed from its support for Zionism, closing the doors for Jews to immigrate to this nascent state of Israel at the most difficult hour for the Jews during World War II, during the Holocaust.
So the promise that was made to the Jewish people with the mandate in Palestine was also made to the Arabs in other countries. So the British broke promises for both sides, and how did that end up fueling a conflict, or could things have been different had they kept their promises?
So in general, after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, a lot of the peoples of the empire were expected to achieve self-determination. The Jews, the Arabs, the Kurds, the Armenians, the Turks. And for a lot of people who think that the Balfour Declaration somehow gave the Jews a state, or that even the mandate system necessarily gave the state, or that it was the British, it's always very instructive to learn about the Treaty of Sèvres that was supposed to create Armenia and was supposed to create a state for the Kurds. And Turkey was supposed to be half the size that it ultimately became. But Ataturk essentially ripped the Treaty of Sèvres. The Turks did what they did to the Armenians, did what they did to the Kurds. And that's it. The Armenians did not have their state. They ultimately got it in the context of the Soviet Union. The Kurds to the present day don't have a state. So when we talked about Zionism not being inevitable, this is a very instructive moment that there were people who were also promised states at that moment, and because of violence, didn't receive it. This could just as easily have been the fate of the Jews. The Arabs believed that they would have one great Arab state. Ultimately, it was broken up to Iraq and Transjordan and Syria and Lebanon, but they did get states. The idea that the Arabs would have self-determination was ultimately fulfilled, not the way they wanted it, but it was fulfilled in having independent states for the Arab members of the former Ottoman Empire. The Jews faced with Arab violence, their fate could have been the same as the Armenians and the Kurds. There was nothing that was guaranteed in the establishment of a Jewish state. Ultimately, it was up to the Jews themselves to fight for it and to bring the state into being. And that's the story, ultimately, of all self-determining nations. It is about the self. You can get international legitimacy. You could get international support. Zionism worked very hard to get international legitimacy and achieved it, ultimately with the United Nations partition plan. But had the Jews not been able to defend themselves and ultimately secure their state, their fate would have been the same as other peoples whose states just did not come into being because of the violence of those who opposed them.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us and learning about religious Zionism and anti-Zionism, both Jewish and Christian. Stay with us for episode 4 as we head to the Middle East. Thank you.